Welcome to the Holistic You community. I'm your host, James Weiler. Like you, I'm an expert in one area. And like you, I'm curious to know more. And that's what this community is all about. It's about asking the right questions to the right people to get the right answers and have a little bit of fun along the way. I hope the answers to these questions makes your journey a little bit easier. Welcome back to another episode of the Holistic You podcast. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of welcoming on the show Alan Patching. Now, I would like to introduce Alan, but I think I'd probably butcher it. So I'll hand over to him to give what's called his elevator pitch, because he certainly has a very distinguished background.
Well, thanks very much for having me, James. I suppose an elevator pitch is more geared at something to get a job, and that's not something I'm interested in, but I think what you meant is talk about the jobs I've already had. I was born on Thursday Island in the north of Australia. I spent some years there and then in Cairns, but came down here for schooling. My early years of schooling was punctuated with trips to hospital for eye surgery and a couple of other problems that I had. I was a bit behind the eight ball to start with at school. But I enjoyed school and I did well. I went to school at St. Bridget's in Brisbane and then at Redhill and then to St. Joseph's at Gregory Terrace, which are very memorable, positively remembered years. Still have a lot of friends from there. I originally studied at what was then QIT, now QUT, Construction and Quantity Surveying. Worked in the government for a while. They started off a project management group and they sent me along as the junior member of that group to study it worldwide. I came back and worked on a couple of projects and then I left and started my own project management group, which celebrated its 41st birthday. So I was invited along as the token historical icon, if you like, for that. So I went along to that. And I ran my own business for many years, became the national projects director of a company called Kumagai. I eventually went on to be project director for the Sydney Olympic Stadium construction and also was CEO of the company that owned the stadium. After which I returned to Brisbane to be project director on the first couple of stages of Lang Park. And for the remaining construction phases, I was an advisor to the Premier, the Treasurer and the Budget Review Committee, etc. And following that, I was teaching overseas for various universities as well as corporate teaching and written a few books to help me with that. And I had the opportunity to being an adjunct at Bond. And while I was doing that, my wife became ill with cancer and I was sick of being away when she needed me at home. So I gave up the travel and Bond then offered me a full-time position 50% of the time and it quickly escalated to full-time and then to an associate dean level. And now at Bond, I hold the position of director of external engagement for the institution, relatively new. I've only been in it 6 months and I'm absolutely loving it. I think the job I have, I've spent a whole career getting the job that I think is the perfect job for me. So I guess it's bringing together the experience back there with what is needed with Bond now. And along the way, I picked up a master in psychotherapy and counselling, university in England, and then did my PhD here, which combined problems in construction from stress and anxiety with aspects of human behaviour and why do those problems occur and why is it people don't talk to them and you know why are there such high suicide rates in construction, etc. So it pulled it all together at the end. A very tall building and a very slow elevator, sorry.
Well, look, there's even some stuff Alan didn't mention there. So I've had the pleasure of knowing Alan for a little while now, and he also was a speaker and he was on the speaker's circuit and you were the curtain raiser for Robert Kiyosaki when you were doing that as well. So yeah, and also not only that, you graduated from officer training school as well back when you were even younger than me, I think, back in your early 20s. So I think it's fair to say you're an overachiever, that's for sure, Alan. So where do we start? There's just so much that we could talk about. So I was thinking that the best thing for the audience would be a bit of knowledge and a bit of inspiration. So if we can start with knowledge, and obviously this Brisbane now has the Olympics and we're going to be rolling that out for 2032. And given your role that you've had in a previous life for the Sydney Olympics, I thought it would be a really good opportunity for you to share those insights. The second part, I think, would be inspiration, and that would be really around how you went about doing all the various things that you did throughout your career and sharing some lessons with us. So we'll break it basically into two episodes. And yeah, this will be the first one with the mainly focused around, you know, the Olympics. So over to you, Alan. What do you think, obviously coming out of Sydney, can you talk us through the kind of preparation you had to do, how it changed Sydney, and obviously some of the learnings from that experience?
Any time that I'm ranting on too much, feel free to interrupt and redirect the question or add another one. Look, Sydney Olympics, I look back at it with a mix of frustration and jubilation, I suppose, because it was a massive stadium. It was the biggest stadium ever built. But it wasn't just that. It was the work that was done around the outside of the stadium, because I guess we had two bits of advice from Atlanta. And one of it was humorous. We had some guy from Atlanta come out, one of the senior project people. And they said, whatever you do, get going as soon as you can, because you don't want to be at Atlanta. He said, Atlanta, we had the problem of the winner of the first 100-meter heat in the 100-meter sprints chasing the painter down the straight, which I thought was a great comment to make. But he was really serious when he said it. He said, we just got there and we were still finishing things during the early event. And they had other social issues as well, like giving anybody who wanted a job would get a job, even people, you know, who were on the street without a job. But there were jobs, big money to get them in and get them working. And that created a bit of a social problem later, because they were spending that money and buying cars, but there was no continuation of the cash flow. We never had any of those problems at Sydney. So we were in a fairly distinct thing there. But they were making the point, just because you've got plenty of time, don't spend too much time before you start using that time towards a productive outcome. And what probably changed the productivity there was a change of government. The Fay government won the Olympics, but not a lot happened. It was all background planning and strategizing. Oh, I wasn't even involved there. This was secondhand information, but no one's ever challenged it whenever it's been discussed. So I'm presuming there's a degree of truth in it. But as soon as it was a change from the Fay government to a Labor government, and I think they got the sense, well, we're behind, so we've really got to hit it. And it did wind up after that pretty quickly. Let's talk about the jubilation first. I don't want to make people depressed about this. There were certain points during the Olympic Games, which were probably, or during the Olympic experience, shall we say, the lead up, which I thought were probably highlights of my entire career. Because if you can imagine getting the number of people involved, all on the same page for the same reason at the same time, it was the ultimate experience that I've had of human connectedness. Now, that might sound really, really positive, but that's how I'd express it. But it needed to be, for reasons I'll tell you as I answer the second part of that question. Now, the two times that happened was when we were heading towards completion, and most Olympic Games, as Athens was a model, were not ideal. And we were aiming at the original completion date without a single day's time extension. And we are aiming at completing at the original budget without a single dollar overrun. That's almost unheard of in huge construction, and pretty much definitely unheard of up until that time, at least, in Olympic construction. So we're really proud of that. And despite the negativity that led eventually to the positivity, the feeling of everybody working together for that opening event was something I'll never forget. It was incredible sense of accomplishment, connectedness, that even though there was some ugly stuff along the way, we got there, and the looks on people's faces and some of the things we had to do to achieve what we achieved. So, you know, I'll probably forget that as I go along, but if you just prompt me, the way we got the press on side and the way we, I don't want to say use the press, but basically that we affected the outcome by using a very good communications consultant about adjusting perceptions to a reasonable level. So I'll come back to that somewhere along the line. So that was one time where we just felt fantastic. The second time was just before the Olympics themselves. We all started working together, a team. Everybody knew there were either one or two things about it that I was not happy with at all. It was a lot of control stuff going on. But generally speaking, the way people worked and buried the hatchets, and there were many hatchets, to make the Olympics something special. No one wanted to be part of a lousy Olympics. And as an example, I went around once with the intention, because I didn't mention it, but I put myself through uni initially. I worked as a sports and fashion photographer and photojournalist. So I used to do columns in Rugby League Week. I wrote for Rugby League World, articles and pictures. And I had the back page of some of the Brisbane newspapers where I do a profile story and a game report every week. So I got to know a lot about what happens in that world. So I guess the second experience of Jubilation, when we're all together for the actual Olympic event, not the opening event that I just spoke about. That was a doubleheader football match, but this is the Olympics. And everybody worked together because they wanted a perfect outcome to the Olympics. And that was a reflection of something happened earlier. I was walking around the site taking some photographs. I've intended to do a book to raise money for the Paralympics, even at the early stages. And a union guy came up to me and said, you can't take photos here of the workers and all that sort of stuff, you know, because I suppose I looked like management or something, I don't know. And he was quite upset. And the last thing you want to do is tick a bloody bloke off who's in the union game, particularly back then. Anyway, I thought, God, this is going to mess up my idea of doing this book to raise some money for the Paralympics. So I immediately got this flash of an idea, and I went to my normal photographic printer because I worked in a fashion and sports photography for a long time and put myself through uni and that. So I use this same guy for printing all the time and said, can you do me a favor? Go through these films, and if you see three people in the film, give me four pictures of it. So I want one and the rest I need. So I ended up the next morning because I told him what it was for, and he said he'd work late and he went to about 2 o'clock in the morning and ended up with a pile of photos that deep. It was amazing. And I went to the union guy and I said, look, I apologize for messing up the photography. I should have talked to you about it first, but this is what the purpose is. I want to raise some money for the Paralympics because I don't get a lot of the funds. And I said, but as a gesture of goodwill, you can do with this what you want. There's a pile of photos. You can ditch them if you want to. But it might be better if you take each one of these photos and give one to everybody in it. And that's what he did. And he became a really close contact. If there was a problem, he'd come and have a word to us about the problem was. If you fix it, there's not going to be a reaction. And every time after that, I'd turn up with a camera. The guys on site, it automatically gathers in group and carry on, like one guy banging the bloke on the head with a hammer on his safety helmet, laughing. And I put that on the back cover of the book when it came out. And it was just an amazing experience. And eventually he said, do us a favor, mate. He said, just bring the camera out twice a week. He said, because productivity goes down the gurgler, because it just became a thing. When these people heard there's going to be a book for the Paralympics, they wanted to be in it. Yeah. And that sense of connectedness of those guys was amazing. And even going back from that, there was one stage where a third of the way through, and there's been no strikes, and this was the highest profile project, maybe not the most expensive, although it was up there, in the country. And if anyone wanted to have a crack, that's what they have a crack on. And I'm thinking, why the hell hasn't there been trouble? And there hadn't. I thought, but if I go and ask them, I might remind them there's been no trouble. So maybe that's not a smart idea. Oh, we haven't struck. Good. We're out of here, man. But eventually there was one guy, he was an Italian bloke who worked for DeMartin and Gasparini, which were a formworking concreting crowd. And he always used to sit in a wheelbarrow. He'd sit in the wheelbarrow, lean back on the slope of it and put his feet up on the handles to have his lunch. And all the young blokes that hang around, the young Italian blokes, there were 60 different nationalities worked on the site. And he'd hang around with all the young blokes and, tell yarns and all this sort of stuff. And he always used to, reminded me of my next door neighbor, and I was going, oh, Eleni, how are you going? And we'd have a chat. And I said, mate, why is it? Tell me, this job, everybody seems to be happy. It's going well. He said, you should know. You've been to university. I haven't, And he was serious. He said, everything else we worked on, we're building bricks and mortar, and that's all it is. We're laying bricks, we're building concrete, and we go home. We don't really care what it is. He said, but here, and this is one of the most insightful things I have ever heard from a human being, and it gave rise to a principle I used to talk about in my lectures. He said, we're not building bricks and mortar. We're building a part of Sydney history. We're building a part of Australian history, but more important, we're building a part of family history. So he said, in 20, 30 years' time, I'm going to sit my grandchildren on my knee and I'm going to tell them that their family, through their grandfather, was involved in building that. And he said, in fact, I probably won't even mention anybody else. I'll let them think I built it myself. He was a real character. And I remember, you know, traveling on speaking circuit with Dr. Dennis Whateley, who's a genius speaker. He won Platform Speaker of the Year, voted by other speakers 14 years in a row in America. He wrote 15 books, all of which were bestsellers except one, and that one he wrote with me, the poor bugger. But basically, it did well, but it was a bestseller in that sense. It was more a textbook. But he has a principle in one of the books he wrote called Look Up to Those Beneath You. Don't presume just because you're senior you can't learn from those below. And that was a moment that just concreted that in my mind. I learned more from that guy than I had in numerous years of university about human nature and all this sort of stuff. So that spirit continued through to the end of the games when everybody's together trying to make it the best games ever. And I'm sure it was the same sentiment, but it wasn't expressed so articulately as it was by that tradesman, in that everybody associated it wanted it to be a success, not so much for themselves, but pretty much burnt out by then. It was really so they could say to their family proudly, we've been involved in one of the best Olympics ever. So I guess that's the good side of the Olympics. Behind, and some of, you know, some of the innovations, you've got a huge stadium and they intend to pull it apart and effectively put it back together again with everything in close to the field because the track was going to go. And halfway through, we came up with the idea, well, why don't we have AFL here? Because as CEO, we're looking at the numbers and they didn't look real flash, trust me. But having AFL there, that made them look considerably flasher. We also said, well, we'll get a club team, which we did for a while, Parramatta, after the games. But when you put 25 or 30,000 people in a stadium that's built for 105,000 people, it looks empty. So that did, and they got their own stadium. And it was always due to be taken down from 105,000. We actually, I think, fitted 115 in for the biggest game at the Olympics or the opening ceremony. It came down to 80,000 roughly, right? And along the way, we said, but in order to make it profitable, we need AFL. But if you're going to have AFL, it means everybody's going to be a long way from the field when it's soccer and that. And we didn't really know what the solution was. And then a group of us went to America to study grass systems. And there was a particular grass system, oval arena system, that was billiard table flat. And so they didn't have it on a curve to for drainage and all that. They actually had suction system underneath where they literally sucked the rain off. 100,000 gallons an hour they could suck off using a set of vacuum pipes under. Very expensive, and we decided not to go with that system for various technical reasons, not the least being that when you pump the water back in, if there's a bug in one part of the field, you spread it to all parts of the field and kill the field. So that was a negative we didn't want to deal with. So we went with a standard field. But when we were over there at the Dolphin Stadium in Miami, they had 5,000 seats because I think it was baseball as well they played, but they adjusted these seats in and out for whatever event was going on. And yeah, you know, the group who were there went, that gives us an idea. If you can do it with that many seats, why can't you do it with, you know, 47 rows of seats, 98 meters long on either side of the stadium? And everybody said, you've got to be kidding. And we said, well, let's look at it. And the engineer said, well, you can do it, but can't do it in steel because everybody's banging their feet. They'll hear it in the city. You know, the locals will go berserk. So can we do it in concrete? And then the engineers got at it again and they found a way to do it with post-tension concrete. And sure enough, the Olympic Stadium now can come back for AFL games and go forward so that they're right on the sidelines for rectangular field sport like rugby, etc. And that's because the stands on either side are on a set of columns that at the bottom have wheels on railway lines, and we just remove some of the grass in panels of grass, trays of grass, and roll it forward and roll it back. And so it's right beside or right back. And as it goes forward, bridges come down so you can walk from one part of the stadium to the stadium, and as it goes back, the same thing happens in reverse. And I've always had this evil thought that it'd be great to go out two-thirds of the way through a game and they've all had half a skinful and just push the button and get photos of the expression on the faces as it started. But I'd probably have to regard that as irresponsible, but I always have a think about doing it. Because knowing where the button is makes you feel very powerful, things like that.
Yeah,
absolutely. So there's some of the positives. You asked me about negatives as well, so I don't want to focus on that too much. But I got to the point on that project at one stage where I was just totally defeated. It was so much internal fighting between groups and arguing and debating. And at one stage, we were working ridiculous hours at times. I went up to the back of the stand. I was just sitting there watching a few after hours workers. And I really was getting there because I was planning to put my resignation in and leave because it was knocking me about and et cetera. So I had a chat with the chairman, and he was an excellent mentor, Stephen Ricks, and ex-banker. And Stephen said, it's one thing to have them get to you, but it's the worst thing, worse the effect of, to have them get to you and let them know they've got to you. He says, so just take time off. And let's talk about attitude change and not taking things so personally. We've got you on to lead the construction of the project and get it done on time within budget. And you're doing exactly what we want. What the government people and other people outside of that want, who cares? We don't. And it was the ultimate short, punchy leadership recalibration. And I decided to stay, and I got the spirit back to say, bugger it. I'm not going to worry about that sort of stuff. We just charged on.
Just to go off on a bit of a segue there or tangent, was that what caused you to study your PhD in that specific area because of what happened to you during the construction of Sydney Olympic Stadium? Like, as in the stress that was related to doing a project like that?
That's an insightful question. I'm tempted to say no, but I think the right answer would be not consciously so.
Yeah.
But having studied as much psych as I have, that pretty much everything you do is affected by things that you're aware of and things that you're not aware of because they're subconscious. So that's a distinct possibility. The conscious version of why I did that was I got intrigued when I read a paper. I'd done a master's course in psych and counseling, and that was 50% study and practice, and the other 50% was a lengthy thesis. And I did that on an aspect, not associated with construction, but an aspect of human behavior in response to stress, quite separate from construction, actually. And in reading papers associated with that, I came about this paper about Australia. It was quite fascinating, that said, since the worst workplace health and safety culture in Australia was being changed by law, with directors becoming responsible for injuries and deaths, etc., the number of injuries in workplaces and on construction sites just dropped off a cliff and become virtually zero. Now, in the same time as days off work because of those sort of injuries got way, way back, the days off for stress-related effects and sicknesses and illnesses in all aspects of industry went up, exponentially. But it flatlined in construction. There was no movement whatever. It was just flatlined. But at the same time that happened and was reported, there was a study done by Griffith University that showed that if you were under 30 working on the tools in construction, then you had a 238% chance of committing suicide over and above what the normal member of the population in that age group would have. And that to me was interesting, and they introduced a scheme called Mates in Construction, and it's been very effective in getting those numbers down. But I thought, well, I've only looked at people on the tools. What about professionals, the people like me who are getting brain fried? Not all the time, just occasionally in the thing. And I was into sport and, I was doing marathon kayaking. So I had a lot to balance the stress. I don't think I felt overly stressed the way through. But there are periods of great stress, if you like, or spikes of it. So, but definitely the thought that I need to understand what the picture is for the professionals and to see if it's anything like it was for the people on the tools. So that's what consciously prompted it, but it may have been subconsciously in part, as you suggest, by my own experience on the site.
Yeah, okay. So just coming back then to the Sydney Olympics, we've sort of covered a bit of some of the negatives being, like you said, the stress stuff, the positives, obviously, from what I can gather, the human spirit of connectedness. And look, it's interesting you say that because I don't think I've ever experienced that myself working, other than when I was part of a deployment for COVID assist and bushfire assist back in 2020. So when we got called out by SCOMO for bushfire assist, you probably remember seeing the guys and girls in green going to assist with the recovery effort. And then for COVID assist, we've just seen the guys and girls in green at the airports, at the border crossings, as well as the hotels. And I can just remember that distinct feeling of people all banding together against a common, call it a common foe, really, you know, with the bushfires and obviously with COVID. And yeah, that's really the only time I've experienced it. So it's an interesting point that you make. It's like if there's something bigger than, you know, bigger than you, yeah, you kind of bond together to get through it. So
it's almost like yeah. your individual ego voluntarily subordinates itself to a collective yeah. ego, and it's not a want to be better ego. It's glad to be part of the group. I experience the same thing here at Bond, because I'm in my 70s. I'm still working. I'll keep working as long. This is the best job I've ever had. And part of it is I'm in a temporary office here at the moment in my new role, and outside is a group of people who deal with the Bond alumni. And just working with that group, the team spirit in that and the sense of everybody wanting to support each other. It's not at that high level stuff, because it didn't start off with conflict and merge into something positive. And yep. Part of the connectedness comes from the sense that you thought this group could never have that experience of connectedness, because they're just so disparate and egotistical and separationist. And I'm sure people thought equally about me, and probably with good reason at the time. But the experience of the positive, one, I think it's very valuable to focus on the positive over the negatives. But when you're looking for an interview like this to give insights to people, that's important. And, you know, we did a lot of technical things wrong that we realized after the fact as well. But technically, most of the stuff, because we had such a top team, you know, we were able to employ the best people we could. So we did. And the technical aspects weren't the problem. It was the human behavior and communication aspects that were the problem.
Yep. Okay. So with moving on to the future of the, you know, Brisbane and the Brisbane Olympics, what do you think it will actually do for Brisbane? Because, you know, we talked about Expo putting Brisbane on the map, or at least that's what my parents used to tell me. But yeah. what do you think? Like, how's it going to change Brisbane, and what benefits are we going to have in Brisbane?
It's an interesting question. The very first comment I'd make is it depends on who we're talking to. If we're talking to young kids at school or in university, you know, people between their 15s and their early 20s, say, my suggestion would be don't focus on the Olympics. It's just a milestone, because when the Olympics happen, they're going to be in their early 30s, mid-20s, right? It's not that darn far away. And the reason I say don't focus on the Olympics, focus beyond, is because your career, if you're in that age group, is going to go well beyond the Olympics. But the good news for them is it's not going to be like, say, the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast, where there's a rush. If you were in construction, you'd have jobs everywhere and it just dropped off a cliff for a while after. It's not going to be like in Sydney. The Olympics were over, and then the site was like a white elephant because there wasn't enough legacy planning. Now, two things have happened there that are different, but I think the most important point to make about it is the Olympics is an opportunity in a career path for the people who are likely to be, even people your age. It's a milestone, and it's a major milestone. But the bigger picture, if you live in Southeast Queensland and you're in virtually any industry, is arising out of the fact that the population of between the Sunshine Coast and the border is expected to double between now and 2050. Now, you think about that. It doesn't necessarily mean double the number of buildings and double the number of hospitals and double the number of roads and all that, but it certainly means a substantial increase in those sort of things. And everything there presents employment opportunities and career opportunities and growth opportunities. However, there's a problem. We've got less than 0.5% vacancy on the Gold Coast and Brisbane area for accommodation, and price of accommodation and rentals going through the roof. That's another driver to make it happen. And one of the reasons that figure exists is because we simply can't get enough builders to put the buildings up as fast as we can, and the developers are getting a bit nervous about the risks that arise from that. So it raises questions about where are we going to get the builders to build the place, the designers design it, and we can look at that as a big threat and a worry, and that's what you might do in a white paper for government or something. But if we look at the people who'll be looking at your podcast here, that represents immense opportunity for people who are educated, have interest, not just in those direct environments, but in all the environments that are associated, all the discipline, which is just about every discipline. You're in financial planning, amongst other things. You're going to have an army of people coming up here to work and live That's just all new market for you. These are great opportunities for people in your field. And it's the same for people in medicine, health, fitness, virtually any field. There's massive opportunities in Brisbane for between now and 2050 with the population. However, that milestone of the Olympics is a darn good one to keep your eyes on, because a lot of the core infrastructure that we're required to run the Olympics will need to be in by the Olympics, which otherwise might be a little bit later in that period of up to 2050. So that's going to guarantee right now someone wants to get a job, unless they're really, really good, they're not going to get a job for 3 years. They're going to get a little bit of bit work, a bit of an internship in some fields. But that's changing. I'm seeing people get out of university and have a job before they leave, or it varies per discipline, but in disciplines where you might have to wait for 2 or 3 years getting bit experience, nowadays they're taking a chance because companies in architecture, construction, project management, who want to be taking advantage of the opportunity the Olympics will present, they're realizing you can't build the resources up after you get the job. You've got to put them on now because they're so rare, and train them into your way of doing things. In other words, model the base material produced by university into something that reflects the culture and values and work processes of the company, so that you're ready. You have to invest in people to be ready to be invested in as an organization. So I think the opportunity is a long-term one, and don't focus on the Olympics as the be-all, end-all, but just be aware of what the opportunities are. And they will be quite substantial. I'm happy to talk a bit about that if you want me to, but there will be across a wide range of areas.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It'd be good to elaborate on that.
Creativity is going to be part of it. Let's have a look at Sydney. Everyone thought Sydney would be a complete lockdown and hopeless during the games, and they had a dedicated lane from the city out to the stadium just for people who are, in the management or senior people involved in the running of the games. And I had one of the passes on my car so I could use that lane. Didn't have to. You could have driven anywhere without a problem. Why? Because they said, buy your tickets for the Olympics over a couple of days, and then do yourself a favor. Rent your house out to a visitor from overseas, and you go on holiday somewhere. And we thought, that's not going to work. Everybody wants to be. But it did. People would stay for a week, and then they'd head away for 2 weeks and rent the houses out. They said, stay off the road and use the buses. And the whole idea was, if you got an Olympic ticket to any event anywhere, you could go anywhere on the trains and buses. So there are no delays or anything. Worked like a charm. The thing was just going in and out to stadiums and other venues without a problem. But there never was a traffic. I don't think I saw one traffic jam. There was never a problem on public transport. So people who can, I don't know whether they'll use the same idea in Brisbane. I think that's been adopted in many places around the world. I think it's been adopted for major football matches, and that even at Suncorp, right? So I'm pretty sure they'll extend on that. And I think the opportunities for creative minds to contribute towards those sort of ideas, I think they're immense. But there will need to be architects, engineers, these sort of people. There'll need to be medical staff to deal. The volunteers, I have no doubt they'll be having a volunteer task force again. There needs to be people who know how to manage those people. There needs to be communication, because the one thing the public wants to know about when you're spending a lot of their money is communication. I'm pretty sure a lot of the people in Brisbane aren't aware that in Sydney, all the money paid on the Olympics was either paid by government or private enterprise, and the stadium was private enterprise. The Sydney Olympic Authority, I was talking to John Coates, the Vice President of the National Olympic Committee, a few months back, because I was on a committee, put together a subcommittee of the Committee for Brisbane, and the Committee for Brisbane subcommittee focused on writing a policy for legacy after the Olympics, because I mentioned you in Sydney, it was like a vacant site, but they don't want that to happen here. So they wrote a 4-pronged policy about developing culture, developing infrastructure, developing Indigenous relationships, and various other things, well ahead of where Sydney was with that sort of stuff alone. But I just wonder to what extent that the people in Brisbane are aware of that. The government's doing another policy or a review of legacy policy, so probably get announced in due course. But I wonder how many people know what Coates told me, and he's announced it everywhere, and that is that Paris Olympics, Los Angeles and Brisbane Olympics, the next three, they will all have money given to them by the Olympic Committee. That never happened in Sydney. So Brisbane's expected to get approximately $1.8 billion contributed by the International Olympic Committee. That's pretty impressive. You know, it makes a big difference to the impact on the city. It allows the money that would otherwise get spent on things that the $1.8 billion is being spent on, the government can spend it on other things that are more long-lasting and not Olympic-specific. And I think that's brilliant initiative and change to the attitude.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like Brisbane due for a lot of positive things into the future with the Olympics. So thanks for this one, and I'll speak to you again shortly.
Okay,
thanks for that.
Thanks for listening to the Holistic You podcast, where we inspire you with the confidence to live a happy, healthy, and more balanced life. If you found today's content meaningful, please tag me in your stories or posts, or follow me on Instagram. Like and subscribe, and leave a 5-star written review.